in Aitkin counties. Reduced visibility on roads expected.
This does not bode well for us. It doesn't bode well for the Venezuelans. It doesn't bode well for regional stability.
The Trump administration is briefing lawmakers on the situation in Venezuela.
We hear from the top Democrat on the Senate Intelligence Committee.
It's Monday, January 5th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. This hour, the scene in New York, where Venezuela's Nicolas Maduro and his wife made their first appearance in federal court.
Also, a group of elementary school students documented the impact of the Palisades fires on their community.
Fires can take things away, but they can't take away kindness. They can't burn up hope.
And for most performers, taking the stage in New York is a dream come true.
We hear from a trio of 90-year-olds about their big breaks.
I love working. I'm still doing film, and I have a great deal of stamina.
First News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Ryland Barton. Ousted Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro made his first appearance in federal court today. A 25-page indictment released over the weekend alleges Maduro provided drug traffickers with diplomatic passports and partnered with drug cartels to send cocaine to the U.S. If convicted, Maduro and his wife could face life in prison. NPR's Jasmine Garce has more on the proceedings.
They came in. Maduro said Happy New Year several times to members of the press and of the public, and almost as soon as he walked in and was asked to confirm that he is Nicolás Maduro Moros, he described himself as the president of Venezuela, and he described himself as a prisoner of war who was kidnapped in his home, and he appealed to the Geneva Convention. His wife, Celia Flores, her right eye looked a bit swollen, her forehead was bandaged, and it was later revealed by the defense that she may have sustained a fracture during the operation.
NPR's Jasmine Garce reporting. U.S. stocks hit new highs today after President Trump announced plans to take control of Venezuela's oil industry. As NPR's Maria Aspen reports, the Dow closed up more than a percent.
President Trump says the U.S. military action in Venezuela will allow U.S. companies to take over the country's oil production. And investors in those companies seem pretty excited about the potential payoff. Chevron is the last major U.S. oil company operating in Venezuela. Its shares soared more than 5% and helped lift the overall market. Shares in ExxonMobil and ConocoPhillips also rose. The U.S. military's capture of Venezuela's president and his wife has stoked concerns about increased geopolitical instability. Prices of gold and silver, typically seen as hedges against uncertainty, rose. So did the shares of major weapons makers and defense contractors. Maria Aspen, NPR News.
Minnesota Democratic Governor Tim Walz has announced today he's ending his bid for re-election. Minnesota Public Radio's Dana Ferguson reports.
The second-term governor said that he will not pursue a third term in office. Walz launched a re-election campaign in September. He said he wants to spend the last year of his term rooting out fraud in state programs. And he said another campaign could pull focus from that. The move comes after the Walz administration faced increasing scrutiny over that issue. The Trump administration has placed a national spotlight on misuse of government funds in recent weeks. Walz was first elected governor in 2018 and previously represented southern Minnesota in Congress. He ran unsuccessfully for vice president on the Democratic ticket in 2024. He says he's confident a Democrat can win the governor's office in November. For NPR News, I'm Dana Ferguson in St. Paul.
It's NPR. The official plaque honoring the police who defended the Capitol on January 6, 2021 is nowhere to be found. It's supposed to be on display at the Capitol, as is required by law. Republican House Speaker Mike Johnson has yet to formally unveil the plaque. The Justice Department is seeking to dismiss a lawsuit asking that it be displayed. Many members of Congress, mostly Democrats, have mounted poster board-style replicas of the plaque outside their office doors. It's known as Black Monday in the NFL, as four head coaches were officially fired after their seasons today, meaning at least six teams are looking for new leadership, including Las Vegas, Atlanta, and Cleveland, where IdeaStream Public Media's Glenn Forbes has more.
Two-time NFL Coach of the Year Kevin Stefanski, who led the Browns to the playoffs in 2020 and 2023, got the boot after a combined record of 8-26 in the last two seasons. Tennessee and the New York Giants fired their coaches midseason. Analysts say Stefanski could be a candidate for both teams. In Las Vegas, despite his Super Bowl resume with Seattle, the Raiders said goodbye to Pete Carroll after 1-3-14 season. Atlanta is looking for a new coach after dismissing Raheem Morris after 2-8-9 seasons. And Jonathan Gannon is out for the Arizona Cardinals, who lost 9 in a row to finish 3-14. For NPR News, I'm Glenn Forbes in Cleveland.
K-pop group BTS's comeback has an official date, March 20th. Will end their nearly four-year hiatus as the seven members had to fulfill South Korea's mandatory military service. The 2026 album will mark their first since their 2022 anthology, Proof. Wall Street gained ground today, led by a mix of energy companies and banks. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Imaginable Futures, funding programs in the U.S. with the goal of ensuring young children and their parents get the education they need to thrive. Learn more at ImaginableFutures.com. This is NPR.
It is 5:06, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. We receive support from Itasca Economic Development Corporation, creating and retaining quality jobs in Itasca County through education, research, and connections with businesses, working to help grow small businesses of all sizes and strengthen our local workforce. Learn more at itascadv.org. Now we'll take you back to All Things Considered.
On a Monday, it's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. It was a stunning scene in a federal courtroom today in New York City. The deposed leader of Venezuela and his wife were brought before a U.S. judge to face multiple charges, including allegedly facilitating the trafficking of thousands of tons of cocaine into the United States. Nicolas Maduro and his wife Celia Flores were both wearing prison uniforms and both entered not guilty pleas. In Venezuela, a new leader was sworn in as interim president, and residents are now attempting to resume life after the U.S. military action over the weekend. For more, let's go now to NPR South America correspondent Carrie Kahn. Hi there.
Hi.
So, Carrie, today we were able to hear directly from Maduro and his wife in federal court. What did they have to say to the judge?
Maduro tried several times to speak directly to the judge who was explaining to him how this initial court appearance would work. He didn't get to give a speech, but Maduro did say in Spanish that was translated to the judge, "I was captured," and when asked for his plea, he said, "I am innocent. I am not guilty. I am a decent man, the president of my country." The former first lady also said, too, she was not guilty, and she had a bandage on her forehead and what reporters in the courtroom were describing as bruising over one eye. Her lawyer says she was injured during the U.S. Special Forces raid on their home in Caracas Saturday when they were both captured.
And Carrie, what have you been hearing from Venezuelans at home watching this, seeing their former leader in court in prison garb?
State TV has not showed any of these images of Maduro in custody. Nothing. There was very little about the court appearance, just shots of the group of supporters in front of the courthouse in New York. Nothing of the other protesters there also celebrating his capture. Plenty of Venezuelans, though, have social media, and they can see these images. But on the streets, the mood is still very subdued. Talking with people, many are still in shock over the U.S. attack. Public transportation, though, is back up and running, and some people have returned to jobs, but plenty of shops and churches and schools are still closed.
And officials in Venezuela, what have they had to say?
This was the first day of the new National Assembly for the year, and members were sworn in, including Maduro's son. He's known as Nicolasito, or the Prince. He gave an emotional, defiant speech pledging support to the acting leader, Delcy Rodriguez. Here he is.
La patria está en buenas manos, papá. Y pronto nos vamos a abrazar aquí en Venezuela.
The homeland is in good hands, Papa, and we will hug each other soon here in Venezuela, he told everybody, holding back tears. And just to note, Nicolas Maduro Jr. is also listed as a defendant on the U.S. indictment against his father and stepmother. And then later, Delcy Rodriguez was actually sworn in as what they're calling the acting or interim president. She was sworn in by her brother, who is the longtime head of the assembly, and here she is.
Para sacar adelante a Venezuela en estas horas terribles,
She pledged to bring Venezuela out of these terrible times that she says is threatening the stability and peace of our country. She really has toned down her rhetoric, though, since President Trump threatened her directly if she didn't come in line with U.S. demands. And so clearly what we saw today, though, was the old guard is still in charge of Venezuela. There has been no big shakeup after the U.S. attack.
No big shakeup. Okay, so where is the opposition during all of this? What have you been hearing?
We have already heard reports today that there's a crackdown on journalists in the country. A union of independent journalists said that there were 7 arrests this afternoon around that National Assembly meeting. One opposition lawmaker stood up during the assembly swearing in and demanded release of all political prisoners. From abroad, we did hear last night in a video statement from Edmundo Gonzalez, who's widely believed to have beaten Maduro in the 2024 presidential election. He called himself the president and demanded also a release of political prisoners.
NPR's Carrie Kahn in Bogota, Colombia. Thank you.
You're welcome.
What is the role of Congress as this whole Venezuela situation unfolds? Senior members of the Trump administration are on Capitol Hill today to brief lawmakers. Senator Mark Warner of Virginia is among those asking questions. He's the top Democrat on the Intelligence Committee. We have him on the line from Capitol Hill. Senator, Happy New Year. Good to speak with you.
Thank you, Marilise. Happy New Year to you as well.
Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, the Attorney General, CIA Director, Defense Secretary, all briefing Congress today. What do you want to know?
Well, first of all, I do want to acknowledge that getting Maduro out of the government of Venezuela, he was a bad guy. And candidly, we should have worked more strongly with the Venezuelan people when they voted overwhelmingly against him in 2024. But that still begs the question of what next? You know, the president says we're going to run Venezuela. For how long? How? If we're going to do it literally with troops on the ground or somehow with simply a fleet threatening offshore? I've got questions about how we got here in terms of the intelligence community's role. I want to get clarification on that. I, of course, won't be able to share that, but I want to get that information. And then, you know, we have heard this theory before that we're going to come into a country, i.e. Iraq, and they're going to pay for the Iraqi oil, will pay for the whole occupation. It appears that the president's making the same claim about Venezuelan oil. How is that going to take place? I mean, the Venezuelan oil fields that used to produce 4 million barrels a day, they're down to 1 million. Everything I've read has said that it would take 2 to 3 years to get those back operational, back to previous levels. Are we there for that long a time?
So you have questions about the budget and who's going to pay for
this. Go on. And then, and finally, just, you know, on a broader basis, you know, the enormous precedent this sets, if suddenly we can go in and snatch a leader if they have violated our law, what would then stop Putin using that same theory of the case to take out Zelensky from Kyiv? Or what would stop President Xi from taking Taiwan, since Chinese law has said that Taiwan is simply a breakaway province?
I mean, you're raising a very big picture question about the global order shifting as we speak. What's the answer to that question? If the U.S. claims the Western Hemisphere, why wouldn't Russia be free to do the same in Europe?
That's why I'm going to ask the question. If you follow the logic, there would not be any preclusion. And I think, you know, for the last 70 plus years, basically since the 60s, I think America, doesn't matter whether it was a Democratic or a Republican administration, has tried to build a new kind of arrangement with Central America and South America, where we looked at those countries as partners. I've always been interested. I was an exchange student in Argentina. I'm fascinated with the region. I think we've traded them, frankly, badly, year in and year out, benign neglect. But the notion that we're kind of reintroducing a colonial / imperial sphere of influence towards everything in the Western Hemisphere, that seems to go against everything of the last 70 years in terms of American foreign policy.
I want to ask about the lack of congressional authorization for this Venezuela attack. Now, Secretary of State Rubio maintains this was not, in fact, an attack. This was a law enforcement operation, and therefore no congressional authorization was needed. Do you buy that?
No, I don't. You know, I worked well with Secretary Rubio. We were good partners when he was on the Intel Committee, and he did— let me be clear, he did try to reach me after the strike had started. We didn't connect, but he did try to reach me. But the idea that somehow this was a law enforcement action, it doesn't pass the smell test. We had a whole fleet off the coast of Venezuela. When you send in the Delta Force, our top military operatives into a nation state to extract their leader, that is not a law enforcement action. And I don't know how we can credibly make that case.
And when President Trump is threatening that there will be additional action if Venezuela doesn't cooperate going forward, you would argue congressional authorization would be needed for that.
I would say, of course, there needs to be. There, and Senator Kaine will have a war powers resolution on Venezuela up this week.
This is your colleague, Senator Tim Kaine.
Yes,
yep.
Mm-hmm. I will vote for that. I'm sure most of the all of the Democrats will vote for it. And the question I have, you know, in terms of congressional oversight, it only works if it's truly bipartisan. And I've had so many of my Republican colleagues, particularly in the last few weeks after the elections in Virginia and New Jersey and New York City, start to say, well, you know, they're maybe willing to speak up more. It'll be very curious to see whether my Republican friends are going to simply continue to write a blank check to this president to take this kind of really significant action without any approval or even pre-warning to Congress.
Stay with that. Senator Kaine, who you mentioned, has tried to get this war powers resolution passed in past. He's not been able to do so because he doesn't have Republican votes. You would need four. Do you see any sign that your Republican colleagues are likely to line up and blocking the president when they have not done so very often at all in the last year?
It's a new year and hope springs eternal. But if I'm laying a wager, I'm not sure. But it's the question is, what kind of action is going to finally spur them into activity?
One more question for you, Senator Warner, and it has to do with the overarching goal here. We were told, Americans were told for months, that the U.S. military buildup off the coast of Venezuela was about drugs, that this was about protecting Americans by fighting drug trafficking. President Trump didn't mention drugs very often in his address from Mar-a-Lago over the weekend. He now seems to be focused on oil. Is it clear to you, from your perch in the U.S. Senate, what the U.S. endgame is?
It is not clear to me. And matter of fact, if you look at the indictment of Maduro out of the Southern District of New York, it doesn't even mention fentanyl at all, which is, again, the drug that is doing the most damage in our country. I think, unfortunately, this is about oil. I think this was ill-advised. I don't think there was a real plan. I do think our military executed brilliantly and Maduro off the stage is good. But, you know, if we really want a collaborative relationship with Venezuela, which we had for many, many decades, we also ought to be interested in the welfare of the Venezuelan people. And this does not bode well for us. It doesn't bode well for the Venezuelans. It doesn't bode well for regional stability.
Virginia Democrat Mark Warner. Senator, thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered.
It is 18 minutes past the hour, and you're tuned in to All Things Considered here on KAXE, KBXE, People Powered Radio. My name is Andrew DeZingle. Coming up at 5:30, it's going to be the Up North Report from our KAXE, KBXE news team. Do you rely on KAXE? Are you at least 70 and a half years old? Supporting KAXE's future is easy. Ask your financial advisor to set up charitable IRA distributions to KAXE. Questions? Call Chris at 218-326-1234. Cohasset Parks and Rec has a full moon hike today at 7:30 p.m. Meet at the Clay Boswell Public Boat Landing. Bring a headlamp and sturdy shoes. The Headwaters Quilt Guild meets Tuesday, January 6th at 6 p.m. at a Stitch in Time in Bemidji. Member Donna Olson will share stories of her recent trip to Bali, along with her experience of making batik fabrics and teaching classes there. The classic movie series continues at the Edge Center for the Arts in Big Fork, Thursday, January 8th at 6:30. This month's film is Spellbound, directed by Alfred Hitchcock and starring Ingrid Bergman and Gregory Peck. The exhibit, Min Hwa Jim Owen, Good Stories, opens at the Watermark Arts Center Friday, January 9th. The exhibit highlights community members who have served the Natahwash community for many years. A reception for the exhibit will be Saturday, February 14th. Curl Masabi invites you to Burger Night Friday, January 9th from 5:30 to 8 at the Eveleth Curling Club. It's a chance to learn the sport in a welcoming environment. Be sure to bring in clean athletic shoes and wear comfortable clothing. Kotaska Community Action offers free lunch every Wednesday from 11 to 1 at their Circles of Support office, located across from Treasure Bay Printing on Northeast 4th Street in Grand Rapids. They also offer a food pantry from 11 to 2, Monday through Thursday. Now back to All Things Considered.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Wallace Foundation, an independent nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, at wtgrantfdn.org.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. 1 year ago, the Palisades fire disrupted tens of thousands of lives in Los Angeles. Among them was a group of elementary schoolers in Carlsbad, 2 hours south of L.A. In interviews and reporting for NPR's Student Podcast Challenge, the fourth and fifth graders of Magnolia Elementary's podcasting club set out to document the impact on their community, including the hope, kindness, and compassion that rose from the ashes of tragedy.
We start today's story with a firefighter who is on the front line, Shane Lawler, a local dad here in Carlsbad.
Engine 33, are you trying to get a hold of engine 39?
So when I first heard about the fires, I was actually not working on one of our fire engines. We went up there just to look around the area and see, and I thought, you know, there's not much I can do. But then when everything came through, we ended up getting punched into what's called a task force, and it was all on. It was all hands on deck. So I really wasn't sure what to think, and it wasn't really a time to think about it too much. Once everything kicked off, it was just know your job and go to work. The hardest part for me was the days after, just going back into those neighborhoods after the fact, after everything had blown through, when it was all done, during daylight, and just seeing how much devastation was everywhere.
Our community and a lot of others around Southern California gained new members because people had no choice but to leave their homes in the path of the fire. That included a little girl named Goldie who came to Carlsbad. One night, her world changed forever.
I felt a little scared. And I saw the smoke from the sky when I was at school. We had to skip lunch. They just sounded the fire alarms and we had to evacuate. Dad packed all the stuff and we went straight to his office. I felt a little sad because my friend Adelia, she had to move somewhere else because of the fires.
There were a few schools that burned down, and then our school did not have running water and had pretty severe smoke damage. And so LA and all the volunteers had camps that they created for the children who didn't have schools to go to. And so Goldie was able, and her brother were able to go to Mar Vista camp. And Goldie, do you want to tell them what you got at the end of Mar Vista camp every day?
Toys, like this egg thing. And you open it up and there's like a stuffy inside.
They had all these big bags of donations that people in Los Angeles had given to the kids who were affected by fires. So we got things like sheets for our beds because those got damaged at home. And Goldie got replacement stuffies and replacement toys and sheets and clothes and all the things that we needed when we couldn't get into our neighborhood.
And from everyone we talked to, we learned this. Fires can take things away, but they can't take away kindness. They can't burn up hope, and they can't stop people from rising from the ashes together. And to everyone listening,
When the world feels heavy, look for the helpers, or better yet, be one.
Those were fourth and fifth graders from Magnolia Elementary's podcasting club in Carlsbad, California, reporting and reflecting on the Palisades fire.
The saying goes, history doesn't repeat itself, but it often rhymes. On Saturday, the U.S. seized an unpopular Latin American dictator and brought him to the United States to face drug charges, just as it did exactly 36 years earlier. In 1990, the target was Panama's military leader, General Manuel Noriega. Last weekend, Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro. NPR's Frank Langfitt reports on the similarities and the big differences between these two U.S. interventions.
President George H.W. Bush broke the news to the nation on January 3rd, 1990.
At about 8:50 this evening, General Noriega turned himself in to U.S. authorities in Panama with the full knowledge of the Panamanian government.
In a news conference Saturday, also January 3rd, President Donald Trump described an even more dramatic scenario.
All Venezuelan military capacities were rendered powerless as the men and women of our military working with U.S. law enforcement successfully captured Maduro in the dead of night.
In both cases, the United States used force in order to secure strategic assets, namely the Panama Canal and Venezuela's oil resources.
We'll be selling oil probably in much larger doses because they couldn't produce very much because their infrastructure was so bad.
And both Noriega and Maduro were widely seen to have stolen recent elections. But the similarities largely end there. Bush announced that American troops would be out of Panama proper by the end of February 1990. The administration also handed over the Panamanian government to the Democratic opposition.
Yesterday, a dictator ruled Panama, and today, constitutionally elected leaders govern.
Unlike in Panama, Trump has dismissed a role for the leader of Venezuela's Democratic opposition, Marina Corina Machado, even though the United States government says her coalition won the country's 2024 election.
Monday.
Oh, I think it would be very tough for her to be the leader. She doesn't have the support within or the respect within the country. She's a very nice woman.
I think everybody who heard that was absolutely shocked.
Javier Corrales is a professor of political science at Amherst College. He says sidelining Machado, who won last year's Nobel Peace Prize, undermines American rhetoric about democracy and could alienate many Venezuelans who voted for a coalition.
This is going to be very, very hard to swallow. I think at some point there are going to be some people interested in giving the United States and the leaders the benefit of the doubt, but this would feel like an incredible betrayal.
For now, Trump appears to be leaving the Maduro regime in place, minus Maduro. He's also said the U.S. will, quote, run Venezuela. Then on Sunday, Secretary of State Marco Rubio said the U.S. would coerce the regime to make policy changes. Here he is on ABC News.
What we are running is the direction that this is going to move moving forward. And that is, we have leverage. This leverage we are using and we intend to use.
After the U.S. invasion, Panama became a stable democracy. Venezuela presents far more challenges. It has seven times as many people and a landmass 12 times larger, plus narco-trafficking guerrillas who can threaten political stability.
I'm Douglas Farah. I am the president of IBI Consultants.
Farah advised the Pentagon for a decade. In 2019, he worked with Trump officials to look at scenarios for Venezuela after Maduro.
The conclusion of everyone was that unless you had some sort of managed transition from the regime to a democratic or some semi-functional democratic system, you would have absolute chaos for a long period of time.
President Trump says at some point there will be a, quote, safe, proper, and judicious transition. Until then, scholars and analysts say the U.S. and Venezuela face a lot of risks. Frank Langfitt, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
It is 529, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up next is the Up North Report. Support comes from Beltrami Electric, a Touchstone Energy Cooperative with a mission to provide safe, affordable, reliable electric service. Beltramia Electric Cooperative, connecting communities, empowering life in northern Minnesota for more than 80 years. Now it's time for the Up North Report from our KAXE KBXE news team.
For KAXE News, I'm Megan Buffington with the Up North Report. Governor Tim Walz is ending his campaign for an unprecedented third term. The DFLer made the announcement Monday amid mounting pressure from members of his own party and intense attacks from Republicans over widespread fraud in state-run social services programs. Walz hosted a press conference Monday morning where he read nearly the same statement that had been shared with media earlier in the day. Here he is in Kara Levin's recording.
Every minute that I spend defending my own political interest would be a minute I can't spend defending the people of Minnesota against the criminals who prey on our generosity and the cynics who want to prey on our differences.
Walz did not take any questions. The Minnesota Reformer reports a source close to Senator Amy Klobuchar says she is seriously considering running for governor. Secretary of State Steve Simon and Attorney General Keith Ellison's names are also being floated once again for the DFL. Both are running for re-election, but were considered possible candidates before Walz announced his campaign. A slew of Republicans have already entered the race, including House Speaker Lisa Damith, MyPillow CEO Mike Lindell, failed GOP gubernatorial candidate Scott Jensen, and former congressional candidate Kendall Qualls. Republican State Representative Peggy Bennett of Albert Lea also recently threw her hat in the ring. The retired educator and six-term legislator says she doesn't like politics, but she does like serving people.
I'm entering this race because I believe I'm different. I know I will be an effective leader and I can get things done for this state.
Her campaign platform focuses on affordable housing and health care, public safety, and education. Former Iron Range teacher Ryan Ross Denzer Johnson was sentenced to 18 years in prison Monday for two counts of first-degree criminal sexual conduct. The 44-year-old pleaded guilty in November. He sexually assaulted an adolescent relative between March 2023 and July 2024. Prosecutors argued for and got the maximum sentence. They say Denzer Johnson abused his position of trust with the victim. They also note that he appeared to know for some time that he had inappropriate feelings for minor females, but continued to serve in youth ministry and as a teacher. In Minnesota, offenders typically serve two-thirds of a sentence in prison and spend the rest of the time on supervised parole. 8 Northland housing projects are among the 51 selected for Minnesota housing financing. The agency announced its annual selections in mid-December. The Hibbing Housing and Redevelopment Authority will build a 48-unit apartment building to replace the blighted Haven Court. The project, called Misabe Manor, will be built alongside Cobb Cook Place. 3 community land trust projects were also selected. The affordable housing model means buyers own the home, but an organization owns the land itself. The Itasca County HRA will build 8 more land trust homes on the former Forest Lake School site. Nonprofit North Star Neighbors will build 6 land trust homes in Bemidji and Warren. And nonprofit One Roof Community Homes will buy and renovate 10 homes to add to its land trust program in and around Duluth. Tribal housing projects from the Red Lake and White Earth Nations were also selected, and the North St. Louis Habitat for Humanity was awarded funds to put toward 8 new homes. Nearly $200 million in funding for rural health is coming to Minnesota. The money is part of the 5-year, $50 billion Rural Health Transformation Program created by the so-called Big Beautiful Bill. Every state got some money in the first year of the program, but the Minnesota Department of Health says it got significant additional funding because of its innovative plan. The agency will use the funds for telehealth and expanding the rural healthcare workforce, among other initiatives. MDH requested $1 billion over the next 5 years. The federal program was created to offset the anticipated cost of Medicaid cuts to rural healthcare, though healthcare officials question whether it will be enough. The state says it will continue to work with stakeholders as it implements the program. That's it for the Up North Report. Find more of our stories and photos at KAXE.org, where you can also find content from our music, phonology, and morning show teams. From the KAXE News Desk, I'm Megan Buffington, telling the stories of northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report is sponsored by Woodland Bank, with locations in Grand Rapids, Cohasset, Hill City, and Deer River, dedicated to serving the financial needs of the community and their customers. More info at woodland.bank.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Odoo, maker of business management software, with the goal of promoting growth and scaling businesses with efficiency. Learn more about Odoo at odoo.com. From the Wallace Foundation, an independent, nonpartisan research foundation, collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's All Things Considered. From NPR News, I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. Allies and adversaries of the Maduro regime have been watching the events unfolding in Venezuela, and they're weighing how to respond and what it means for them. That includes Russia, an ally of Maduro. NPR's Charles Maines is in Moscow and is here to talk about Russia's stance on all of this. Hi there.
Hi there.
Charles, let's start with Moscow's formal response to the U.S. attacks and the arrest of Nicolas Maduro. What are they saying?
Well, we haven't heard from Russian President Vladimir Putin, at least not yet. It's just about Orthodox Christmas here, and instead of commenting on Venezuela, Putin today was awarding gifts to kids by phone. Now, his foreign ministry has issued a statement calling the Trump administration's pretext for attacking Venezuela unfounded. They're demanding Maduro's release from U.S. custody, saying it was an unacceptable assault on Venezuela's sovereignty. So Moscow is expressing outrage, but it's just that, an expression, words. But Russia stopped short of challenging the Trump administration more forcefully amid this months-long pressure campaign against the Maduro regime. In fact, the Kremlin reportedly rebuffed a request by Maduro for direct military assistance in the fall. And the reason, it seems, was Moscow's desire to maintain good relations with Trump as it tried to sway him over any peace deal for Ukraine. And, of course, there's also the fact that because of that war, Moscow doesn't have that much military equipment to hand out, not even to its friends.
And speaking of friends, Charles, remind us of the nature of the relationship between Russia and Venezuela.
Well, they weren't that close during the Cold War, but that changed with the revolution in Venezuela that brought Maduro's predecessor, Hugo Chavez, to power near the turn of the millennium, a time, by the way, when Vladimir Putin also happened to show up in the Kremlin. So in pretty short order, Venezuela becomes Russia's most important trading partner and military ally in Latin America. Oil was always at the center of that, but so too were shared foreign policy goals, particularly when it came to countering U.S. influence on the global stage.
So we've talked about the official response, but what about the Russian people? What has been their response to U.S. actions in Venezuela?
Yeah, this is the latest in a string of recent foreign policy setbacks for Russia concerning its allies, and nationalists in particular here have been angry and loud about it. There was the collapse of the Assad regime in Syria in 2024. You remember that dictator Bashar al-Assad fled to Russia in the aftermath. There were these U.S. airstrikes against Iran, another ally, over the summer, and of course Trump continues to threaten the Iranian regime. And yet, like in Venezuela, Moscow's basically stood aside. Meanwhile, this U.S. attack on Venezuela, the capture of Maduro, it sure looks like a more confident version of the military operation the Kremlin launched against Ukraine in 2022. So there's some envy here, a point raised to me by Abbas Galyamov, a former speechwriter for Putin, who's now a critic in exile.
What Trump did to Maduro, actually Putin should have done to Zelensky. Trump solved the problem within just half an hour. Putin is still going through painful and big expenses in people, in money, in sanctions, and he is far from being successful.
So there's some hard questions here being asked.
How damaging is this ultimately to Putin's image?
Well, Putin is unchallenged at home, but it doesn't exactly serve his image as a leader who is, if not respected, then at least feared on the global stage. You know, it also dents Putin's reputation among allies, many of them autocrats, frankly, who may be wondering if they're next on Trump's list. On the other hand, Trump's rationale for his actions in Venezuela, you know, they sound awfully in tune with Putin's own justification for the invasion of Ukraine. And arguably, that legitimizes Russia's might-makes-right approach when it comes to securing its own backyard. So all of this can really cut both ways.
NPR's Charles Maines in Moscow. Thanks.
Thank you.
Here in Washington, Congress is back this week, and one of the first tasks for the House of Representatives is a vote on a bill to renew now expired health insurance subsidies, despite objections from Speaker Mike Johnson. Now, this is not the first time in this Congress that enough Republicans have joined with Democrats to circumvent the Speaker using a previously obscure maneuver called a discharge petition. NPR congressional reporter Sam Greenglass explains.
Speaker Johnson for weeks refused to allow a vote to extend subsidies for Affordable Care Act marketplace plans, even as more than a dozen members of his caucus pressed for action before they expired at the end of December. Some of those Republicans, like Congressman Mike Lawler of New York, were fuming.
It is idiotic and shameful. This place is disgraceful. Everybody wants the political advantage. They don't actually want to do the damn work.
So just before Congress left town for the holidays, Lawler and three other swing district Republicans joined with Democrats to force a vote on a three-year extension. The method? A discharge petition, which allows 218 or more members to sidestep the Speaker and force a vote in the House. The subsidies would still have to pass the Senate, which already voted down a three-year extension. But Lawler told NPR that for him, the petition was a last resort to recharge negotiations.
I don't want to go down this road, but unfortunately, we were left with no alternative after we exhausted every other option.
Use of the discharge petition is surging. In the fall, five Republicans joined with Democrats to compel a vote overturning President Trump's order ending collective bargaining rights for many federal workers. A discharge petition also forced a vote mandating the Trump administration release the investigative files on convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein.
The last time we had a Congress that had this much success with the discharge petition, oh, it was 90 years ago.
That was during the Great Depression, says Molly Reynolds of the Brookings Institute. The tool originated two decades earlier as rank-and-file members struggled to push back on then-Speaker Joseph Cannon.
Sometimes referred to as Czar Cannon to give you a sense of how members felt about the amount of power he was trying to exercise.
But unlike those members more than a century ago, lawmakers today see Johnson less as an iron-fisted ruler and more as a speaker missing in action. In announcing her exit from Congress, Republican Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene slammed Johnson for letting bills by the rank and file collect dust and keeping the House out for the entire 43-day shutdown.
The legislature has been mostly sidelined, and we are entering campaign season, which means all courage leaves and only safe campaign reelection mode is turned on in the House of Representatives.
The willingness of some Republicans to buck their speaker has also given Democrats unusual sway to force votes advancing their own agenda. Johnson has brushed off the flurry of successful discharge petitions as unavoidable when it only takes a few defections.
This is not a challenge to the Speaker's leadership. Here's the reality, everybody. We have a razor-thin majority, a record small majority.
Johnson spoke to reporters in December.
It's not an act of defiance. Every member has a different district with different dynamics and different demographics.
But Mike Ricci, who served as a top staffer under former Republican speakers John Boehner and Paul Ryan, says there's more to the story.
If members don't trust the speaker, they don't feel like the speaker has their back, there's no question this is a direct referendum on the speaker himself.
Ricci says both Boehner and Ryan sometimes struggle to wrangle unwieldy Republican caucuses.
It was unruly, but it was not unproductive. With enough talking, with enough back and forth, we could figure out a path forward to keep the House moving.
In this era, some members now see the discharge petition as the tool to keep the House moving. And with a growing track record of success, more may be on the way. Sam Greenglass, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to All Things Considered. You might think of Reno, Nevada as a hot, sun-baked town, but the high desert climate means a big swing from summer to winter, and people without shelter face freezing temperatures. As part of our series Here to Help, reporter Phil Corbett met with someone bringing people in from the cold.
On a recent evening in Reno, the rain lets up after sunset and the headlights of passing cars reflect on the wet pavement. It's cold, and about 25 people line up behind the Catholic Church. When the clock strikes 9, they're welcomed inside by Lilith Barron. Barron wears a black leather jacket with patches sewn on the back. She is one of the organizers of Good Neighbors Warming Center.
We can see when folks are able to access a good night's sleep, their cognitive ability improves, their mood improves, and hopefully their lifespan is extended.
Washoe County offers beds at a county-run shelter and some additional overflow beds, but Barron says it's outside of downtown where most of the people who are homeless live. Good Neighbors Warming Center is in downtown, and it's a collaborative effort between local mutual aid groups and several churches.
Yeah, it's really interesting because although we might have different walks of life, some people are, you know, radical mutual aid people, some people are advocates, some people are churchgoers, but I think we all have the same thing in common, which is that we want to see people cared for and we want to treat everyone the way we would want to be treated. And at the end of the day, that's really all that matters.
The Warming Center is just one piece in a constellation of mutual aid efforts led by Barron. She also runs a community refrigerator in her front yard and distributes DIY heaters for people sleeping outside. Back in the basement of the church, Alana Fanning is checking people in for the night.
It's rainy, wet, and cold. I have on 3 sweatshirts and 3 sweatpants just because I get so cold, so I couldn't even imagine having to be out there in this.
Fanning has been working here with Barron since last year.
Her vision works. It's not overly complicated. We're just housing people, and she's a mastermind, and I have so much respect for her.
As people stream inside, Barron hands out little bags with toiletries and extra clothing. She knows how big of a difference a little support can make.
I experienced homelessness in 2020 with my son. I had to live in my car. And though I am, you know, an educated problem-solving person, the only reason that I'm not still homeless right now is because I had friends with money that could help me get on my feet. And so I kind of just want to be the person that I needed and try to figure out some of these problems that are not being solved by government.
Here at the Good Neighbors Warming Center, there are 25 quilt-covered cots lined up in rows. Barron and the others will do this every night through winter.
There's hope in giving back, and there's hope in receiving back and just being a part of something. You don't have time to despair when you're a part of something.
Barron says it's not that complicated. Hungry people need food, homeless people need housing, and she says everyone has the power to help. For NPR News, I'm Phil Corbett in Reno.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 5:48, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. We receive support from Rapids Brewing Company, a place for gathering and community featuring live music multiple times a week, farm fresh food, and rotating beers from their own brew house. More information about their events, music, and menu available at rapidsbrewingco.com. Check KXE.org for information about food-related resources across northern Minnesota, with hours of operation and locations of food shelves, along with information on soup kitchens and community meals. Add resources in your region by emailing news@KAXE.org. Itasca Waters continues their Practical Water Wisdom webinar series, Thursday, January 8th at noon. This month, hear about traditional ecological knowledge with Shane Bowe, Water Resources Director for the Red Lake Nation DNR. Register at itascawaters.org. The American Red Cross is in need of blood and platelet donations to help keep supplies steady. Find a blood drive near you at redcrossblood.org. The Buck Lake Improvement Club has their monthly breakfast buffet Sunday, January 11th from 9 to noon at their community center, 12 miles north of Nashwauk on Highway 65. Enjoy a blizzard of flavors. The Sac Zim Bog near Meadowlands has a snowshoe hike Sunday, January 11th from 9 to 1. This hike will explore the Sac's wildlife management area. Register in advance at saczim.org. The Grand Rapids Area Library Fund has been established at the Grand Rapids Area Community Foundation. The goal is to raise $300,000 by September 1st, 2026. Funds will be earmarked for the library's 2027 budget. Elder Circle in Grand Rapids has monthly support groups for caregivers at various times and locations. Find a full schedule at eldercircle.org. Now back to All Things Considered.
As All Things Considered from NPR News, I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Professional actors and singers are like athletes. They use their bodies constantly, performing up to 8 times a week. Remarkably, 3 different women in their 90s have been gracing New York stages this season. Reporter Jeff London caught up with them, barely.
Look, once you hit your 90s, you'd be excused if you retired and kicked back your heels, but not these 3 women.
I love working. I'm still doing film, and I have a great deal of stamina.
That's Academy Award-nominated actor June Squibb. She turned 96 during rehearsals for the Broadway play Marjorie Prime. Down the block, 97-year-old singer Marilyn May has been doing her New Year's show at Birdland twice a night.
As long as I'm still in this game, I want to play for laughs, for life, for love. So here's to life.
I sing. I just keep singing. There are no exercises. The show is the exercise.
Ann Reed, who at age 90 is the youngster of the group, is making her Broadway debut in a modern dress version of Oedipus. She was visiting New York last year when at Thanksgiving dinner she told the guests,
"Well, my dreams of working on Broadway have passed me by. That's never going to happen now. I'm at my stage. And ta-da, you know, the following year." Here I am, so my motto is never give up on your dreams.
And really, what is showbiz but chasing dreams? June Squibb has been acting for over 7 decades. She lives in California, and her agent asked her if she'd like to come back to Broadway to star in Marjorie Prime.
So they sent the script, and I read it, and I thought, oh, I should do this. And I can do it, you know, physically, because I now have to think physically, can I do things?
Squibb, who walks with a cane, spends most of the sci-fi play sitting in a chair. Cynthia Nixon plays her daughter. At first, Marjorie is an elderly woman with dementia.
I had a friend named Rosemary. She's dead.
Well, what a good story.
In the second part of the play, Squibb plays Marjorie Prime, a holographic AI version of the character. Physically, she sits up a little straighter.
And then vocally, I felt it would be a little musical. You know, it would be a little trilly. It wouldn't be my natural voice.
Many singers' voices change over the years, but Marilyn May's instrument has remained remarkably intact.
Sometimes I work 4 days a week, 6 hours a day. You know, I think that's one of the reasons why my voice is hanging in there. And then I just do so many shows, you know, each year.
Of course, it helps when you're working with a great set of pipes to begin with. And that voice made her a frequent guest with Johnny Carson on The Tonight Show.
I did The Carson Show 76 times.
One of my favorite singers. She really is outstanding. Get her records there or listen to her. You can hear the lyrics, you hear the story, and she knows what it's all about.
Life is a cabaret, old chum. Come to the cabaret.
May did the first commercial recording of Cabaret, and she still sings it in the same key.
Cabaret, old chum. Come to the cabaret. Come
Marilyn May's got bookings through next November, and Reed is working on a cabaret act for after Oedipus closes, and June Squibb has four film projects coming up. All three talk about the need for rest, from naps to a good night's sleep. Still, Anne Reed doesn't think of herself as old.
I thought by the time you get to this age, you would feel differently, but you don't. It's just that people treat you differently. I'm having a good time at a party until somebody comes up and says, you're amazing, and then I want to hit them, you know, because suddenly they remind me that I'm old and I don't want to be reminded.
As the cliche goes, and these women prove, you're only as old as you feel. For NPR News, I'm Jeff London in New York.
Time now for My Unsung Hero, our series from the team at the Hidden Brain Podcast. My Unsung Hero tells the stories of people whose kindness left a lasting impression on someone else. Today, we revisit a story from John Kinshu. In 2013, John had two young children, and he was on track to become a partner at an international law firm. But then, one day that September, he began to feel very dizzy. He was admitted to a medical center in St. Louis. That's where he met his unsung hero, his hospital roommate.
My speech started to decline quite rapidly. It was at this time that my unsung hero pushed the call button on his bedside remote. Medical professionals rushed into my room and began to think I was suffering from a stroke because my speech was clearly affected. Without him, doctors would not have known to perform the life-saving surgery needed on my skull. Now, I would like to tell him that I am doing much better. I am driving, and I have returned to work. Most importantly, I am once again daddy to a little girl who was born years after my stroke. If I had died, my child would never have been born. I want to say that he not only saved me, but in doing so, he saved my unborn daughter. I will be blessed for the rest of my entire life because of my unsung hero's actions.
John Kinshu of St. Louis, Missouri. You can find more stories of unsung heroes and learn how to submit your own at hiddenbrain.org.
Support for My Unsung Hero comes from Viking, dedicated to creating travel experiences for the thinking person, with programs designed for cultural enrichment on board and on shore. Learn more at viking.com.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Fisher Investments, Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Imaginable Futures, funding programs in the U.S. with the goal of ensuring young children and their parents get the education they need to thrive. Learn more at imaginablefutures.com. From Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, a personalized program that bases rates on safe driving habits, at progressive.com. Not available in California or from all agents. and from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
You are listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids and 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio, telling the stories of the people and land of Northern Minnesota through music, news, conversation, and events. Operating translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9. Listen at KAXE.org or on your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234. Thank you. We receive support from Lake Country Power, a Touchstone Energy Cooperative, serving more than 44,000 members in northern Minnesota. Lake Country Power, energy that powers our lives. Weather tonight, cloudy skies. Overnight lows 15 to 20 degrees with a chance of widespread dense freezing fog. Chance of freezing rain and a winter weather advisory in Crow Wing and Aitkin counties. Reduced visibility on